I've been debating with myself about the approach tonight. There are two ways that I would like to do it. I can't do both. But just in order to be consistent, I think I'll continue doing it the way we've been doing it. And I'll just tell you about the other way to do it. The themes of death and love, the being of death and the being of love, the voice of death and the voice of love. This is the theme of part three, and it is about the transformation of death. So I think we don't know anything about any of these three terms, really. Immortal divine love and absolute nothingness and the transformation of the one by the other after death of the body. These are things that we don't know about normally. We don't experience them. We're in a kind of superficial human dilemma between two absolutes. And both of the absolutes are ever present. And if we were conscious of either one of them, we wouldn't bother with this. Very much, at least. So, the idea of the transformation of death is that this reality that we experience can become something else through a very special energy of the two. Did you want to ask a question, Paul?
I would say that we had an experience of our past death, but we drank river, lettuce, waters, and we forgot it.
You said you had too much to drink? What?
said after you die, you drink water or river, lettuce.
Lettuce.
Facing the old memory of past life. So you are, what's necessary you have it, but it's really no detail, nothing. You are just newborn, like a number one. But you carry all the past with you. So we.
Sounds like a story.
Yeah, the father asked.
So here with Savitri, because Sri Aurobindo is communicating to us about things which for us basically don't exist in experience, we need to be able to make a special effort, and he needs to make a special effort to communicate to us something about that. Now, this special effort is called mantra. It is a power of transmission of the thing itself through speech. So it doesn't require us to have any prior knowledge of it. But it does require us to receive the transmission. And for that, an extraordinary effort of energy is required, both on the part of the seer and the hearer, the singer and the receptive consciousness. Extraordinary effort. also beyond our normal range. So only by practicing mantra yoga can it be achieved. So in part three, which is the transformation of death, part one is yoga of Aswapati, part two is yoga of Savitri, and part three is the yoga of the transformation of death, we're in a territory that is unequivocally, categorically beyond our comprehension. So that's something that's important to, I believe it's important for us to realize that. In this book 9, we had an introduction to the experience of death and the relationship between the human soul and the divine Shakti after death. That's what we heard last time. And that's one of the themes that runs through this section. Another theme that runs through this section is the relationship between absolute death and absolute love. And a third theme that runs through this book is the experience of death itself. There are many descriptions of death itself. So my approach here is to read some selections through tonight, Book 10, a little bit at the end of Book 9, but mostly Book 10, to just get a taste of these dualities, these themes, so that we know what's there. In some sense, knowing being subject to a variety of meanings. Another approach would be the mantric approach. For example, there is a 12-page passage in Book 10 which is the length of the average length of a canto. And so Book 10 is quite long, and this canto is very long and entirely beyond our ability to hear it tonight. But in the debate of love and death, there is one speech of Savitri that is 12 pages long. And in this passage, there is the achievement, the ultimate achievement of the possibility of mantra. The power of the sound itself and the sequence of images and rhythms that are created allows Sri Aurobindo to cover the entire progression from the origin of life through its evolution, through the yoga of transformation, to the ultimate confrontation with death and its conquest and the final illumination. And by the time one gets to the end of that passage, if one hears it correctly, which can't be done with the eyes don't hear anything, One is literally in that state of receptivity necessary for knowing to some extent what Sri Aurobindo is trying to communicate. And as far as I know, there is no other way to know that, because I don't think anyone else has had the power to do that. So in the yoga of Savitri, and by that I mean the path of Savitri, one can read, and we could tonight easily read those 12 pages, and experience the full potential of mantric transmission. And that would enable us to know everything that we need to know about part three of Savitri. But then there's all of the debate between love and death, and all of the experience of the relationship between the soul of the mortal and the divine Shakti that we miss if we do that. So that's been my debate today with myself. So I just want you to know that in the book of Love and Death, the debate of Love and Death, before there is actually a continuation of the debate which we'll already hear tonight, because it goes all the way from book 9 up until this point. After all of that, there is this extraordinary revelation of the affirmation of everything as God. The complete affirmation of the darkness and the light and all the stages of transition, the tragedy of time, and the only device that is used is seeing speech. There is nothing to be thought in those 12 pages. Everything is to be seen and heard transparently. It's an extraordinary thing. So sometime we'll do that. Tonight, I'm going to start where we stopped last time. I made the comment that one of the things that we notice... Yeah, I'm going to fix it. After this moment of the near disappearance of Satyavan and the surging forward of the divine, the power of divine love to embrace and in herself his soul, I said that what happens next is the confrontation, her confrontation with the darkness, and this theme runs throughout these next six cantos. There is literally, I mean literally, experientially, in this process of confrontation between the light in and around the mortal soul after death, a gradual emanation of spiritual light. And that grows and grows and grows until its culmination. It's pure energy. Sri Aurobindo is writing about a phenomenon of after-death experience. And we can trace this progression of light through these cantos, not in a metaphorical way or an allegorical way, but in an intensity, by growing intensities. So that's one of the things that we'll try and do a little bit of tonight, to notice that and to hear it and see it. But there are at this point also some interesting descriptions of the death experience. So I want us to hear some of this. Starting here, a short passage. Which is neither the voice of light nor the voice of death, but a narrative. But after this, we'll mostly hear voices. We'll really concentrate on the voices after this. Solitary in the anguish of the void, she lived in spite of death. She conquered still. In vain, her puissant being was oppressed. That means it was kind of useless of death to try to oppress her, because she wasn't going to be oppressed. Solitary in the anguish of the void, she lived in spite of death. She conquered still. In vain, her puissant being was oppressed. Her heavy, long monotony of pain, tardily of its fierce self-torture, tired. At first, a faint, inextinguishable gleam. Pale, but immortal, flickered in the gloom. As if a memory came to spirits dead, a memory that wished to live again, dissolved from mind in nature's natal sleep. It wandered like a lost ray of the moon, revealing to the night her soul of dread. Serpentine in the gleam, the darkness lolled, its black hoods jeweled with the mystic glow. Its dull, sleek folds shrank back and coiled and slid, as though they felt all light a cruel pain, and suffered from the pale approach of hope. Night felt assailed her heavy, somber rain. The splendor of some bright eternity threatened with this faint beam of wandering truth, her empire of the everlasting naught. Implacable in her intolerant strength, and confident that she alone was true, she strove to stifle the frail, dangerous ray. Aware of an all-negating immensity, she reared her giant head of nothingness. Her mouth of darkness, swallowing all that is. She saw in herself the tenebrous absolute. but still the light prevailed, and still it grew. And Savitri to her lost self awoke. Her limbs refused the cold embrace of death. Her heartbeats triumphed in the grasp of pain. Her soul persisted, claiming for its joy the soul of the beloved now seen no more. Before her in the stillness of the world, once more she heard the treading of a god. And out of the dumb darkness, Satyavan, her husband, grew into a luminous shade. Then a sound pealed through that dead, monstrous realm. Vast like the surge in a tired swimmer's ears, clamoring a fatal iron-hearted roar. Now this is why that sound comes out the way it does. That is not something that is to be read silently or whispered or articulated with the tongue and the teeth. It comes from the throat center and the vast. It's not an intention. It's a transmission. It's not mental. It's mantric. And in this room, it is mellow at this point. But I'll tell you, there is power there that we could hear. Death missioned to the night his lethal call. This is my silent, dark immensity. This is the home of everlasting night. This is the secrecy of nothingness, entombing the vanity of life's desires. Hast thou beheld thy source, O transient heart, and known from what the dream thou art was made? In this stark sincerity of nude emptiness, hopest thou still always to last and love? Although thou hast survived the unborn void which never shall forgive, while time endures, the primal violence that fashioned thought, forcing the immobile vast to suffer and live, this sorrowful victory only hast thou won. To live for a little without Satyavan. What shall the ancient goddess give to thee, who helps thy heartbeats, Only she prolongs the nothing dreamed existence and delays with the labor of living thy eternal sleep. A fragile miracle of thinking clay, armed with illusions, walks the child of time. To fill the void around, he feels and dreads the void he came from and to which he goes. He magnifies his self and names it God. What's that?
He's kind of cheeky.
Yeah, well, so is she. As we will now hear. Because this is a debate. She's not going to take this lying down. On a stretcher. Or any other place. I bow not to thee, O huge mask of death. Black lie of night to the cowed soul of man. Unreal, inescapable end of things, thou grim jest played with the immortal spirit. Conscious of immortality, I walk. A victor spirit, conscious of my force, not as a suppliant to thy gates I came. Unslain, I have survived the clutch of night. My first strong grief moves not my seated mind. My unwept tears have turned to pearls of strength. I have transformed my ill-shaped, brittle clay into the hardness of a statued soul. Now in the wrestling of the splendid gods, my spirit shall be obstinate and strong against the vast refusal of the world. I stoop not with the subject mob of minds who run to glean with eager, satisfied hands and pick from its mire, mid many trampling feet, its scornful, small concessions to the weak. Mine is the labor of the battling gods, imposing on the slow, reluctant years the flaming will that reigns beyond the stars. They lay the law of mind on matter's works and win the soul's wish from earth's inconscient force. So she gave him a piece of her mind, didn't she? And death made answer to the human soul. What is thy hope? To what dost thou aspire? This is thy body's sweetest lure of bliss. Assailed by pain, a frail, precarious form, to please for a few years thy faltering sense. With honey of physical longings, and the heart's fire, and a vain oneness seeking, to embrace the brilliant idol of a fugitive hour. And thou, what art thou, soul? Thou glorious dream of brief emotions made, and glittering thoughts, a thin dance of fireflies speeding through the night, a sparkling ferment in life's sunlit mire. Wilt thou claim immortality, O heart, crying against the eternal witnesses that thou and he are endless powers and last? Death only lasts, and the inconscient void. I only am eternal and endure. I am the shapeless, formidable vast. I am the emptiness that men call space. I am a timeless nothingness carrying all. I am the illimitable, the mute alone. I, death, am he. There is no other God. All from my depths are born. They live by death. All to my depths return and are no more. I have made a world by my inconscient force. My force is nature that creates and slays the hearts that hope, the limbs that long to live. I have made man her instrument and slave. His body I made my banquet, his life my food. Man has no other help but only death. He comes to me at his end for rest and peace. Are you convinced? So this is the kind of dialogue which goes on between the reality of death and the reality of love. Two infinite, immortal principles of existence that coexist, both real. Now there is the next book in which the various illusions of existence, vital and mental and spiritual, are gradually dismantled and reconstructed and dismantled and reconstructed to show us the fragility of everything that has been created. And there is, it becomes more and more tangible until we get to the book of the dream twilight of the earthly real, when it comes down to almost back to gross reality and all of its lives and deaths. But now we're still in this realm of subtle, the subtle world. And the subtle world is also a world of lives and deaths, of positive experiences and negative experiences. And so there is a passage in death, which probably doesn't have any space, spatial dimensions. It's a journey through planes. And so here we have the subtle planes of life and mind and overmind, and then a descent back into the more and more gross planes, always from the point of view of eternal life and eternal death. All the positives and negatives that it's possible to exist get mutually their chance to be and not be. But here is a tone of experience where there's a transition that's quite interesting, I think, if we can hear it. The dream twilight of the ideal. The dream twilight of the ideal. All still was darkness, dread and desolate. There was no change, nor any hope of change. In this black dream, which was a house of void, a walk to nowhere, in a land of naught. Ever they drifted without aim or goal. Gloom led to worse gloom, depth to an emptier depth, in some positive non-being's purposeless vast, through formless wastes, dumb and unknowable. An ineffectual beam of suffering light, through the despairing darkness, dogged their steps. She behind them, Satyavan and Death. Like the remembrance of a glory lost. Even while it grew, it seemed unreal there, yet haunted Nihil's chill, stupendous realm, unquenchable, perpetual, lonely, null, a pallid ghost of some dead eternity. It was as if she must pay now her debt. Her vain presumption to exist and think. To some brilliant Maya that conceived her soul, this most she must absolve, with endless pangs, her deep original sin, the will to be. And the sin last, greatest, the spiritual pride, that made of dust equaled itself with heaven. Its scorn of the worm writhing in the mud, condemned, ephemeral, born from nature's dream, refusal of the transient creature's role, the claim to be a living fire of God, the will to be immortal and divine. In that tremendous darkness, heavy and bare, she atoned for all since the first act, whence sprang the error of the consciousness of time. The rending of the inconscience seal of sleep, the primal and unpardoned revolt that broke the peace and silence of the nothingness which was before a seeming universe appeared in a vanity of imagined space, and life arose engendering grief and pain. A great negation was the real's face, prohibiting the vain process of time. And when there is no world, no creature more, when time's intrusion has been blotted out, it shall last, unbodied, saved from thought, at peace. Accursed, in what had been her Godhead source, condemned to live forever empty of bliss, her immortality, her chastisement, her spirit guilty of being, wandered, doomed, moving forever through eternal night. But Maya is a veil of the Absolute. A truth occult has made this mighty world. The Eternal's wisdom and self-knowledge act in ignorant mind and in the body's steps. The inconscient is the superconscience sleep. Assailed in the sovereign emptiness of its reign, the intolerant darkness paled and drew apart, till only a few black remnants stained that ray. But on a failing edge of dumb, lost space, still a great dragon body sullenly loomed, adversary of the slow, struggling dawn, defending its ground of tortured mystery. It trailed its coils through the dead, martyred air, and curving fled down a gray slope of time. There is a morning twilight of the gods. Miraculous from sleep their forms arise, and God's long nights are justified by dawn. There breaks a passion and splendor of new birth, and hue-winged visions stray across the lids. Heaven's chanting heralds waken dim-eyed space. The dreaming deities look beyond the scene and fashion in their thoughts the ideal worlds. Sprung from a limitless moment of desire that once had lodged in some abysmal heart, past was the heaviness of the eyeless dark, and all the sorrow of the night was dead. Surprised by a blind joy with groping hands, like one who wakes to find his dreams were true, into a happy, misty, twilight world where all ran after light and joy and love, she slipped. There, far-off raptures drew more close, and deep anticipations of delight, forever eager to be grasped and held, were never grasped, yet breathed strange ecstasy. A pearl-winged indistinctness fleeting swam, an air that dared not suffer too much light. Vague fields were there, vague pastures gleamed, vague trees, vague scenes, dim-hearted in a drifting haze. Vague cattle, white, roamed, glimmering through the mist. Vague spirits wandered with a bodiless cry. Vague melodies touched the soul and fled, pursued into harmonious distances unseized. Forms subtly elusive and half-luminous powers, wishing no goal for their unearthly course, strayed happily through vague ideal lands, or floated without footing, or their walk left steps of reverie on sweet memory's ground. Just to have a taste of... What's happening here is that she is drifting in a subtle world of delightful images that she sees of things, the forms of things that are perceived in this death state. Delightful things. He has passed through that darkness into a twilight in which she can see these things. These fugitive beings, these elusive shapes. There's a summary of this. All in this world was shadowed forth, not limbed. Like faces leaping on a fan of fire, or shapes of wonder in a tinted blur, like fugitive landscapes painting silver mists, her vision fled back from the sight, alarmed, and sound sought refuge from the ear's surprise, and all experience was a hasty joy. The joys here snatched were half-forbidden things, timorous soul bridles delicately veiled, as when a goddess's bosom dimly moves to first desire, and her white soul transfigured, a glimmering Eden crossed by fairy gleams, trembles to expectation's fiery wand. But nothing is familiar yet with bliss. As if a music old, yet ever new, moving suggestions on her heartstrings dwelt, thoughts that no habitation found, yet clung with passionate repetition to her mind, desires that hurt not, happy only to live always the same and always unfulfilled, sang in the breast like a celestial lyre. Thus all could last, yet nothing ever be. In this beauty, as of mind made visible, dressed in its rays of wonder, Satyavan before her seemed the center of its charm, head of her loveliness of longing dreams, and captain of the fancies of her soul. Even the dreadful majesty of death's face and its somber sadness could not darken nor slay the intangible luster of those fleeting skies, the somber shadow, sullen, implacable, made beauty and laughter more imperative. Enhanced by his gray, joy grew more bright and dear, his dark contrast edging ideal sight deepened unuttered meanings to the heart. Pain grew a trembling undertone of bliss, and transience immortality's floating hymn, a moment's robe in which she looked more fair, its antithesis sharpening her divinity. A comrade of the ray and mist and flame, by a moon-bright face, a brilliant moment drawn. Almost she seemed a thought, mid floating thoughts. seen hardly by a visionary mind, amid the white inward musings of the soul, half vanquished by the dream happiness around. A while she moved on an enchantment soil, but still remained possessor of her soul. Above, her spirit in its mighty trance saw all, but lived for its transcendent task. Immutable, like a fixed eternal star. Then pealed the calm, inexorable voice, abolishing hope. Prisoner of nature, many visioned spirit, thought's creature in the ideal's realm, enjoying thy unsubstantial immortality, the subtle, marvelous mind of man has feigned. This is the world from which thy yearnings came. When it would build eternity from the dust, man's thought paints images, illusion rounds. Prophesying glories it shall never see. It labors delicately among its dreams. Behold this fleeing of light-tasseled shapes, aerial raiment of unbodied gods, a rapture of things that never can be born. Hope, chance to hope, a bright, immortal choir. Cloud satisfies cloud, phantom to longing phantom leans sweetly. Sweetly is clasped or sweetly chased. This is the stuff from which the ideal is formed. Its builder is thought, its base the heart's desire, but nothing real answers to their call. The ideal dwells not in heaven nor on the earth. A bright delirium of man's ardor of hope, drunk with the wine of its own fantasy. So she was only drifting through an illusory world of death experience. Dreams and memories and hopes and ideals. Mind made. But Savitri replied to the dark power, "A dangerous music now thou findest, O death, melting thy speech into harmonious pain, and flutest alluringly to tired hopes thy falsehoods, mingled with sad strains of truth. But I forbid thy voice to slay my soul. My love is not a hunger of the heart, My love is not a craving of the flesh. It came to me from God, to God returns. Even in all that life and man have marred, a whisper of divinity still is heard. A breath is felt from the eternal spheres, allowed by heaven and wonderful to man, a sweet fire rhythm of passion, chance to love. There is a hope in its wild infinite cry. It rings with callings from forgotten heights, and when its strains are hushed, to high-winged souls in their empyrean, its burning breath survives beyond. The rapturous core of suns that flame forever, pure in skies unseen, a voice of the eternal ecstasy. One day I shall behold my great, sweet world put off the dire disguises of the gods, unveil from terror and disrobe from sin. Appeased, we shall draw near our mother's face. We shall cast our candid souls upon her lap. Then shall we clasp the ecstasy we chase. Then shall we shudder with the long-sought God. Then shall we find heaven's unexpected strain. Not only is there hope for Godhead's pure, the violent and darkened deities leaped down from the one breast in rage to find what the white gods had missed. They too are safe. A mother's eyes are on them, and her arms stretched out in love desire her rebel sons. One who came, love and lover and beloved, eternal, built himself a wondrous field and wove the measures of a marvelous dance. There, in its circles and its magic turns, attracted he arrives, repelled he flees. In the wild, devious promptings of his mind, he tastes the honey of tears, and puts off joy, repenting, and has laughter, and has wrath, and both are a broken music of the soul which seeks out, reconciled, its heavenly rhyme. Ever he comes to us across the years, bearing a sweet face that is the old. Bearing a new sweet face that is the old. So, the next book, I mean, the next canto is The Debate of Love and Death. And as I said, there is a 12-page incantation of the totality of lightness and darkness. And at the end of that, there is a final debate that this growing light has. That I would like us to hear at the end of this section. Don't look at the screen, I'm going to go for a ride here that's pretty fast and furious. I'm skipping a whole long book and going to the end of a second long book that sums up these debates. And there are two, there's not only one long passage of Savitri, the voice of illumined speech, Savitri. There's that 12-page one, and then there's an 8-page one in the next canto. Are you coming back, Sigbert?
Yes.
Okay. So this turns into this these cantos in these books build up to a level of energy and fluidity and harmony and power of speech that is entirely transcendent and almost impossible to actually contain by the vocal cords and the space around, which is why we're not going that route tonight or in this session. But it's there. And this is just a culmination, a brief culmination of these very long passages. So if you can imagine, there are these very long passages, 12 pages, 8 pages of continuous inspired revelatory energy. So that when we get to the end of the canto, like this sort of final debate, we should be in a vibrational space of receptivity in which we behold clearly and absolutely these principles in all their radiant, immortal truth. And then we hear, then we would hear something like this, but quite different. But just this, just the idea of this then death the last time answered Savitri. Then death, the last time, answered Savitri. If Truth Supreme transcends her shadow here, severed by knowledge and the climbing vasts, what bridge can cross the gulf that she has left? Between her and the dream world she has made. Just in these few lines, there are vibrations that reach both worlds. If Truth Supreme transcends her shadow here, severed by knowledge and the climbing vasts, what bridge can cross the gulf that she has left between her and the dream world she has made? Or who could hope to bring her down to men and persuade to tread the harsh globe with wounded feet, leaving her unapproachable glory and bliss, wasting her splendor on pale earthly air? Is thine that strength, O beauty of mortal limbs? Is thine that strength, O beauty of mortal limbs? O soul who flutterest to escape my net? Who then art thou, hiding in human guise? Thy voice carries the sound of infinity. Those are not words on paper, and they don't mean what they say. They mean what they say exactly. This is Savitri that we are hearing. Thy voice carries the sound of infinity. Knowledge is with thee. Truth speaks through thy words. The light of things beyond shines in thy eyes. But where is thy strength to conquer time and death? Hast thou God's force to build heaven's values here? This is the question that death puts to Savitri. I mean, this is the question that death puts to Savitri. If knowledge brings not power to change the world, if might comes not to give to truth her right, a blind force, not truth, has made this ignorant world. A blind force, not truth, orders the lives of men. By power, not light, the great gods rule the world. Power is the arm of God, the seal of fate. O human claimant to immortality, reveal thy power. Lay bare thy spirit's force, then will I give back to thee Satyavan. Or if the mighty mother is with thee, show me her face that I may worship her. Let deathless eyes look into the eyes of death, an imperishable force touching brute things transform earth's death into immortal life. Then can thy dead return to thee and live. The prostrate earth, perhaps, shall lift her gaze and feel near her the secret body of God, and love and joy overtake fleeing time. And Savitri looked on death and answered not. Almost it seemed as if, in his symbol shape, the world's darkness had consented to heaven light, and God needed no more the inconscience screen. A mighty transformation came on her. A halo of the indwelling deity, the immortal's luster that had lit her face and tinted its radiance in her body's house, overflowing, made the air a luminous sea. In a flaming moment of apocalypse, the incarnation thrust aside its veil. A little figure in infinity yet stood and seemed the eternal's very house, as if the world's center was her very soul, and all wide space was but its outer robe. A curve of the calm hauteur of far heaven descending into earth's humility. Her forehead span vaulted the omniscient's gaze. Her eyes were two stars that watched the universe. The power that from her being's summit rained, the presence chambered in lotus secrecy, came down and held the center in her brow, where the mind's lord in his control room sits. There, throned on concentration's native seat, He opens that third mysterious eye in man, the unseen's eye that looks at the unseen. When light with a golden ecstasy fills his brain, and the eternal's wisdom drives his choice, and eternal will seizes the mortal's will. It stirred in the lotus of her throat of song, and in her speech throbbed the immortal word. Her life sounded with the steps of the world soul, moving in harmony with the cosmic thought. As glides God's Son into the mystic cave, where hides his light from the pursuing gods, it glided into the lotus of her heart, and woke in it the force that alters fate. It poured into her navel's lotus depth, lodged in the little life nature's narrow home. On the body's longings grew heaven rapture's flower, and made desire a pure celestial flame. Broke into the cave where coiled world energy sleeps, and smote the thousand-hooded serpent force, that blazing towered and clasped the world self above, joined matter's dumbness to the spirit's hush, and filled earth's acts with the spirit's silent power. Thus changed, she waited for the word to speak. Eternity looked into the eyes of death, and darkness saw God's living reality. Then a voice was heard that seemed the stillness's self, or the slow or the low, calm utterance of infinity when it speaks to the silence in the heart of sleep. I hail thee, almighty and victorious death, thou grandiose darkness of the infinite, O void that makest room for all to be, hunger that gnawest at the universe, consuming the cold remnants of the suns, and eatest the whole world with thy jaws of fire. Waster of the energy that has made the stars, inconscience, carrier of the seeds of thought, nescience, in which all knowledge sleeps entombed and slowly emerges in its hollow breast, wearing the mind's mask of bright ignorance. Thou art my shadow and my instrument. I have given thee thy awful shape of dread, and thy sharp sword of terror and grief and pain to force the soul of man to struggle for light on the brevity of his half-conscious days. Thou art his spur to greatness in his works, the whip to his yearning for eternal bliss. His poignant need of immortality. Live, death, a while. Be still, my instrument. One day man too shall know thy fathomless heart of silence and the brooding peace of night and grave obedience to eternal law and the calm, inflexible pity in thy gaze. But now, O timeless mightiness, stand aside and leave the path of my incarnate force. Relieve the radiant God from thy black mask. Release the soul of the world called Satyavan, freed from thy clutch of pain and ignorance, that he may stand master of life and fate, man's representative in the house of God, the mate of wisdom and the spouse of light, the eternal bridegroom of the eternal bride. The two opposed each other face to face. His being, like a huge fort of darkness, towered. Around it her light grew, an ocean siege. A while the shade survived, defying heaven. Assailing in front, oppressing from above, a concrete mass of conscious power, he bore the tyranny of her divine desire. A pressure of intolerable force weighed on his unbowed head and stubborn breast. Light like a burning tongue licked up his thoughts. Light was a luminous torture in his heart. Light coursed a splendid, agony through his nerves. His darkness muttered, perishing in her blaze. Her mastering word commanded every limb and left no room for his enormous will that seemed pushed out into some helpless space and could no more re-enter but left him void. He called to night, but she fell shuddering back. He called to hell, but sullenly it retired. He turned to the inconscient for support, from which he was born, his vast sustaining self. It drew him back towards boundless vacancy, as if by himself to swallow up himself. He called to his strength, but it refused his call. His body was eaten by light, his spirit devoured. At last he knew defeat inevitable and left crumbling the shape that he had worn, abandoning hope to make man's soul his prey and force to be mortal the immortal spirit. Afar he fled, shunning her dreaded touch, and refuge took in the retreating night. The dire universal shadow disappeared, vanishing into the void from which it came. Now they find themselves in this luminous plane, disembodied, free, infinite, full of the Divine Mother. Death still has his dominion. But for the soul and his spiritual bride, for the bridegroom and the bride, there is now infinite freedom and bliss, but they are on that plane. They have achieved a certain immortality. The last book, actually it's the penultimate book, but in this series it's the last book, the Book of Everlasting Day, has another debate. The debate between this incarnate goddess of love and the Supreme Lord of Love, between Ishwara and Shakti, between the Absolute and His Absolute. Now what? What is the process now? When we enter, should we enter death in yoga and experience this conquest of the divine force, then we are faced with what she is faced with, what they are faced with. They are free, infinitely, luminously, powerfully free. They are in the absolute state of love and bliss and freedom. So then there has to be another debate. Because whatever step is beyond that hasn't been taken before. At least not in a way that is meant to achieve something here that hasn't been achieved before. So that last long canto is full of mysteries. So we'll review a few of those next time. Next Wednesday, the last meeting of this class.
I would just add another question. How should we survive without this class is not?
Don't worry, you'll manage. But it's nice that you asked the question.
Because it doesn't wait till October next year, it's long. I think we should have a meeting in
What I would like to do is meet in the hall downstairs, the mother's hall, maybe once a month, and just read a canto from beginning to end.